very much. Thank you for the opportunity to give this lecture, and thank you all for coming. as just said, I'm a PhD candidate here at the University of Oxford, and I'm also part of the Transforming Musicology project. And one of the project strands is looking at the reception and perception of Wagner's leitmotifs. And within this strand, we had a team of music psychologists looking at making perception experiments with leitmotifs. And there's also my project where I'm looking at mostly printed, but also in other media, but reception documents that are mostly introductory literature and are supposed to explain Wagner's music to an audience. So I'm pursuing a rather traditional musicological question, and at the same time I'm exploring how digital technologies and especially semantic web and linked data technologies are able to help with this question. This is a work in progress, and it's meant to give an example of how semantic web and linked data can be applied to the humanities, not only to publish data or knowledge or output that has been generated, but also as a method or tool for analysis. But let's start at the beginning, and I'm going to give a little bit of musicological background, because I see some of you are in the digital musicology strand, but not all of you. So let's start at the very beginning and say, what is a leitmotif, and why should we be interested in looking at the reception of leitmotifs and of how people have described them over time and in different cultural contexts? So the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians defines leitmotif as follows: a theme or other coherent musical idea clearly defined as so as to retain its identity if modified on subsequent appearances, whose purpose is to represent or symbolize a person, object, place, idea, state of mind, supernatural force, or any other ingredient in a dramatic work. Yeah, that's very abstract. Let's look at a very well-known example. gonna try and play this. So far. This is an excerpt from the Ride of the Valkyries, from the third act of Wagner's opera Die Walküre, from the Ring des Nibelungen. It's very well known. I suppose that most of you might know this already. And it accompanies the entrance of the eight Valkyries on stage, who were originally intended to enter the stage on live horses. Here it's fashioned into a full-blown orchestral introduction, but this main theme, this da 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 da, it occurs in many places within the music dramas, and it's used for many different purposes. It has many different functions. So here we see this main theme extracted, and a beautiful picture of Amalia Materna as Brunhilde from the first performance of the Ring. So these were the figures, the characters that were usually originally intended to be accompanied by this music, but it also is used in very different functions in very different situations, and also it has very different structural functions. I want to show you a second example where just the main theme is taken from this musical introduction, and it's used in the singing voice and metrically shifted in the accompaniment. And it's taken from the second act of Die Walküre, from a monologue of Wotan, where he talks about the Valkyries and how he used to send them out to battle. Okay, so far here as well. So here it's used in quite a different way. It's located in the singing voice, and it's used to structure a monologue, to give presence to a monologue, to illustrate the ideas that are being talked about, not that are being seen on stage. And there are, I could quote many, many other examples. So just to give you an impression what leitmotifs are and in which different manners they can be used within Wagner's works. So they are, as we have heard, coherent musical ideas with a clear identity that is recognizable and, dependent on that, also a considerable potential for variation, transformation and combination with other musical ideas. And they also have an adaptability, as we also heard here, to a wide variety of different contexts within the work, within the music dramatic configuration. And Wagner, as we also have seen here, uses them to on the one hand construct musical form, but on the other hand also to convey musical expression and musical meaning. So for instance, the Rite of the Valkyries, it does not simply accompany the entrance of the Valkyries, but at the same time, by virtue of the musical expression, that makes use of established topoi, of stylistic and expressive conventions, and the associations connected to them, it characterizes the Valkyries, it characterizes the characters that it accompanies, it adds some meaning to the dramatic situation. And Wagner neither invented the term nor the phenomenon. Reminiscence motif were used before him and by other composers after him, but he used them in a very specific way and made these musical ideas a significant pillar of his musical form, structure and coherence, and one of his primary means of musical expression. But leitmotifs are not only important in the creation, in the composition of a musical work, but also in its reception. In Wagner's own theory of his composition with characteristic motifs, the role they play for the appreciation and the understanding of his work and the effect they have on the audience are as prominent as their structural functions. So for instance, he describes the characteristic motifs that he uses as emotional guideposts that are supposed to lead the audience through the drama. And also, he characterizes their primary functions, or some of their primary functions, as reminiscence, realization or presentation, and anticipation. And these also can be seen as not only functions within the work, but functions within the work and the audience, because they pace the music and the drama for the audience. They create expectations. And Thomas Gray, in a broader cultural analysis of the development and functions of the metaphors leitmotif and corresponding leitfaden, which are commentaries on leitmotifs, which developed after the premiere of The Ring des Nibelung, asserts this interdependency of compositional and receptional phenomena when he says, leitmotivic composition and leitmotivic reception might be in some degree interdependent. Any theory of how leitmotif can succeed as a compositional principle in Wagner or elsewhere ought to consider the historical conditions that made the principle viable in the first place. the possibility that Wagner's leitmotif technique was to a certain extent sponsored by a willingness, even a predisposition, among some listeners to listen leitmotivically. So reception plays an exceptionally important role if we're talking about leitmotifs. In line with these observations, leitmotifs have played a very prominent role in the whole discourse about Wagner's music, both in academic literature, but also there's a broad corpus of more popular audience-aimed or introductory literature that is concerned with leitmotifs. For instance, on the occasion of the premiere of the Ring des Nibelungen in Bayreuth, Hans von Wolzogen published a little booklet called Thematischer Leitfaden, Thematic Leading Thread, which aimed at explaining Wagner's new and complicated music in terms of leitmotifs, by extracting leitmotifs from the musical context, by giving them a descriptive name that was supposed to capture their dramatic meaning, and then by re-narrating the music, not the story, but narrating the music in terms of the interactions and of leitmotifs, which leitmotifs follow each other, which leitmotifs occur together with each other. And following this, a broad corpus of literature following this model developed, where people aimed at explaining Wagner's music in terms of leitmotifs. And these interpretations have been very different in terms of which names they assign to leitmotifs, which dramatic meanings they assign to leitmotifs, which structural characteristics they emphasize within leitmotifs, and the whole aesthetic conception they promote of the phenomenon leitmotif. And they are very different between each other, and also very different to Wagner's authorial conception. So it seems like a worthwhile undertaking to look at different interpretations in different historical and cultural contexts. And the sources that I'm mainly looking at are introductions and leading threads, like this Leitfaden you can see here, the title page, and one of the pages from the content, where you can see that you have text, and then Wolzogen identifies the leitmotif with a name and a number, which is in bold, and then you have a notation example, and it's described in several different ways. It's described the musical shape is described, the meaning is described, and so on. And there are also other sources that follow this model. For instance, we have piano scores, which are annotated with leitmotif names, and which have tables of notation examples extracting leitmotifs. And which also, within the score, have a continuous annotation with numbers that refer to the leitmotif table, so as to have a continuous annotation within the work directly. And then there's a third form that's also important in this context. These are libretti, which have leitmotif tables which you can fold out, and then they have names of leitmotifs in the margins to refer to the leitmotif table that comes with it. So I'm trying to explore this material in order to find out how Wagner's leitmotifs have been interpreted and understood in different times and cultural contexts, and in which ways these reception practices mirror the culture and time they originate in. And also, and this is a little more specific, which version of the work are they conveying? What are the characteristics of the work? What are the characteristics of Wagner's leitmotif technique that is conveyed in each of these interpretations? And also, how do these interpretations influence each other? As I already said, there are many different sources and many different formats. And leitmotif concepts within these sources are identified by a number of different, or represented by a number of different components. So we already saw that they are assigned a name, they are assigned a number, they are represented with a notation example. There are also, for example, audio guides that have sound examples of leitmotifs, and so on. And all of these things make it quite difficult to compare leitmotif interpretations between sources, because within one source, you can say, oh, this is a leitmotif concept, it's called Walkürenmotiv, and it is assigned to this specific notation example. But between sources, it quickly becomes complicated. And I'm going to show you this in an example. This is a passage from Wolzogen's thematic leading thread, which shows the fate motif. And if we extract the information about leitmotifs that is contained in there, it looks something like that. So it has a notation example, it has a name, or in this case it even has two different names, but the name that is repeated within the guide is fate motif, usually. It has a number, it has a description of the dramatic situation, and that Wolzogen says it appears when the Valkyrie enters the stage. It has a description of the expression of the motif. It refers to a certain place within the work. And it is described in its relation to certain other motifs that are described elsewhere in Wolzogen's booklet. And if we now compare this to a passage from Heinrich Porges' rehearsal notes. Heinrich Porges was a musical assistant of Wagner, and during the rehearsals to the Bayreuth premiere of The Ring, he took notes of everything that Wagner said, and also about the descriptions that Wagner gave about his leitmotifs. And if we compare one of these descriptions with a description from Wolzogen, it becomes clear how complicated it can be to compare these different interpretations. Because if we look at this, it also assigns a place within the work. It also has a kind of name, a designation, and it describes the expression. And it's quite clear that the melodic shape is the same. In both cases, we have this da da da. So the melodic shape is the same thing, but the harmonies are different. And as we can see, they both refer to a different place within the work. So is this then still the same motif? Where do we draw the boundaries? And also both refer to the to fate in their name or designation, but in a different way. One says fate motif, and the other says question to fate. Is this the same thing? Does it make a big difference? Which elements do we want to capture? Which elements do we want to compare? And how can we express that? How can we structure and express that things are in some ways similar, in some ways not similar, in some ways the same, in other ways completely different. And this is another passage from the same book, from the same rehearsal guides, from Heinrich Porges. And here, it's another occurrence of the same musical idea, but it's again described differently. And I think we can imagine that if we take 10, 20, 30, 40 other sources, how complicated it can be to really become a detailed impression of how people actually saw these motifs and how interpretations evolved. So the challenges are that the relationships between these interpretations are complex and different differentiated. And also it's very difficult to establish a basis of comparison. What shall be the basis of comparison? Shall it be the same musical idea? Shall it be the same place within the work? Is the semantic sphere that is assigned to the motif more important than the form of designation that is, for example, called a motif, a theme, or something like that? And also, it's further complicated by the different formats of the sources, by the different media they come in. Because sometimes you will not even have a stable representation, because one motif might only have a sound example, the other might only have a text quotation, and you need to establish that they are in fact referring to the same thing. So the solution to this problem that I proposed is making use of techniques from semantic web, knowledge representation, and linked data. Because, as I think, they allow us to model these complex relationships in an explicit and structured way, to represent them in an explicit and structured way, and they allow a semantic description of the sources that provides computer-assisted capabilities of searching and restructuring the material. What that exactly means, I will come to that in a second. I just want to once more take a very small step back and say, what is this semantic web and linked data? I'm not going to give a comprehensive introduction because I'm sure that most of you will have those within the workshops or have already had those within the workshops, but just a very brief note about the general idea. So the idea behind the semantic web is that the World Wide Web is a web of documents that can be navigated by humans and read by humans and navigated by hyperlinks. But there's lots of data which can't really be accessed because it's in either proprietary formats or it is in isolated containers like databases. And the idea behind semantic web and linked data is to get those data sets out of their isolation and create links between them to create a web that is human and machine readable. And this is achieved by assigning unique identifiers to resources and by describing resources and connecting them to each other using a data model called RDF, Resource Description Framework, which basically describes resources in the form of simple statements or triples in the form of subject, predicate, object, which are on their own very simple statements. Which can be combined into complex and large graphs. And this, the result of this is that distributed data sources become interlinked and reusable and navigable by machines. And you probably already have seen this as well. This is a graph of the linked open data sets available as of 2014. And this basically means that there already is a large amount of interlinked data on the web. And if we adhere to these principles, we can also make our data that we generate in our research projects available within this, this context and also make use of making connections to already existent data, to already existent knowledge, and expand our own project. And what are ontologies? Ontologies are formal and explicit definitions of concepts, their attributes and the relationships between them and other concepts. And they are modeling and or capturing information or knowledge in a certain domain. And ontologies are basically the components that give the meaning to the RDF statements. So the statement, if you have the statement Richard Wagner is a composer, and you can have an ontology which explicitly defines the concept of a composer, which adds formal meaning to this statement, Richard Wagner is a composer, because he is asserted as a member of the class composer, and he's immediately connected to other members of the same class. This example is obviously much, much oversimplified, but just to get a very, very brief idea, and we have more complex examples later on. So ontologies allow us to do exactly what I think I need to do with the material I am confronted with. They allow us to model the structure of the domain, which in this case is music interpretation or the interpretation of Wagner's music, to model the concepts that define it and the complex relationships between these concepts and their different instances, and let us create an explicit and structured representation. And they allow us to describe the content of the sources semantically so that they can be restructured and queried by a computer. So, but especially if we want to use those techniques not only to publish our data but as part of our analytic procedure, we need to think about how semantic web methods fit in with more traditional musicological methods. And as both involve a different way of thinking, a different perspective, a different view on the world, we need to think about how we can reconcile these different perspectives. Especially if we don't just want to replace old methods by new ones, which would consequently mean setting up digital musicology as a separate field, but if we rather want to integrate it and actively interact with existing methodologies and existing values and integrate it with traditional musicology. So because of this, we need to ask ourselves a question, I think, which I adapted from an article about code ecology and the semantic web. How do musicological methods translate into methods of semantic web research and the other way around? So basically, both domains are concerned with dealing with information, with generating, creating knowledge and conveying it, but they do it in profoundly different ways. If we want to apply semantic web technologies, our information needs to be explicit, it needs to be formally structured, it needs to be formalized and unambiguous. And musicological scholarship mostly isn't, and for good reason. It has a different way of dealing with complexity. As we have seen in linked data models, complexity is made up of small statements, which can form complex networks, but inherently it's made up of small building blocks. But humanities often build on the inherent complexity of a single statement, for example. They are dependent on the use of metaphors, of analogies, of dialectic thought, and similar things. So we need to think about how we can deal with these, how we can reconcile these different ways of dealing with complexity, of dealing with knowledge. How can we bridge this gap? And what I'm proposing is, firstly, to choose suitable questions, or the other way around, choosing suitable methods. As we have seen in the project that I've presented, I've started with a preliminary analysis of the sources. So as to identify where do I want to go with this? What is interesting about it? What do I want to ask? What do I want to find out? And then I thought about methods to achieve this. Which means that the research is led by questions rather than methods. A second point is that I would deem important is incorporating ambiguity, flexibility, and other specific qualities of the domain into the models, and then meeting existing standards and expectations, and not only standards of semantic web and linked data, but also musicological standards. For example, the terminology needs to fit in with existing terminology in musicology. The terminology and the model needs to have an historical and critical awareness. And lastly, the model needs to describe the actual situation, the actual material and perspective that we want to have on this material, instead of fitting the material that we have to a given model. And semantic web and linked data methods and technologies bring certain advantages with them to address these issues. For instance, you have with ontologies, you have the possibility of designing a custom-made model that can nonetheless fit in with existing structures. You can use the existing structures to design your own model that fits your needs and your domain. It's declarative or descriptive rather than prescriptive, so it can fit to the actual material. Because it's extendable, you don't need to design a rigid model and stick to it. It's based on an open world assumption, which means if something isn't there, it doesn't mean it's wrong, it just means it's missing. And it could at any point be extended or added. It also enables the linking of distributed data sources. That means if I want to deal with a data source, I don't need to have it on my machine, but I can take it from somewhere in the web, because I can use a web URI, an identifier, which is dereferenceable about HTTP, and then I can pull together distributed data sources. And it enables the integration with existing data sets, which also I think is, especially for the humanities, a really important point, because as we heard in the opening lecture on Monday, universities are not monopolies of knowledge anymore. There's a lot of community-generated knowledge. There's a lot of knowledge generation outside of universities. And if we miss the opportunity to join in with that, we might have the authority, but authority might lose its value or its impact. So it's really important also to fit in with traditional methodologies, but also to see where things are going in the world and to join in with them as well. So now I want to talk a little bit about the actual design of the ontology, and how I went about doing it. There are different design patterns and methodologies for designing ontologies. And also, which is also something important, there's not one correct model of a particular domain, but it also always depends on what the ontology shall be able to do. It depends on the objectives, the questions, the requirements. And the steps that I like to talk about now are defining the purpose and the scope of the ontology, identifying concepts and relationships, building a formal model, implementing and evaluating this. And as I said, this is a work in progress, so I am currently at the implementation stage. So what I can show you is mostly the conceptual model. I'd like to start with talking about defining the purpose and the scope. What does that mean? It means to say, what is the domain of the ontology? What shall it describe? What is the reason for building it? What are the requirements? What is the level of detail that is required? And that can be captured in motivating scenarios and competency questions. And in a way, I already presented that to you, the whole motivation section, the whole opening section. This is my motivating scenario. This is what I want to do with the ontology. And my research questions, the general ones that I've already told you, as well as the more specific ones, for example, which names specifically have been assigned to particular musical ideas over time or by different authors, which musical motives have been identified by a particular name, and so on. These are my competency questions. These are the questions that the ontology shall help me to answer in the end. So then, to the second step, identifying concepts and relationships. Sorry. So I have chosen a bottom-up approach. So I'm starting with just a structural analysis of the sources. I'm looking at the sources, I'm starting with the actual material and just analyzing their structure, analyzing what are the aspects that are important for me. And from this step, from identifying the important aspects, I'm moving on to identifying concepts and relationships, and then I'm generalizing this to more abstract levels. So I'm starting at the actual source material and building my model from bottom up. And the relevant aspects that I want to represent in my ontology are, firstly, contextual information about the sources themselves, about the authors, about how they are related to each other and how they are related to the work that they are describing. And then the structure and content of the interpretations, the actual leitmotif concepts and their constituent elements, how are they represented in the interpretations. And then explicit and implicit relationships within and between sources and within and between concepts of leitmotifs. This is also the place where we shall think about if there already exists something that we can reuse, because we don't need to start from scratch every time. There are existing vocabularies and ontologies, and if there is something that fits our needs, it's good to reuse it. So for the contextual information, this is the main part where I will be able to reuse existing ontologies, such as Ferber, which is a bibliographic model, such as Friend of a Friend or Vocabulary from Dublin Core. I'm not going to present those in detail. I think you might have linked data introductions in your workshops, so then. Otherwise, if you have any questions, you can. We are welcome to ask me in more detail about this afterwards. So, the modeling the contextual information is the place where it is best suited for me to reuse existing models. And this is essentially what I want to represent. And I'm using concepts and relationships from the Ferber bibliographic model here. So we have, and this is also, I have to say, this is simplified. In general, this would be, it doesn't seem to be working, sorry. But this works, I think. This would be a resource with a URI which has the title, thematic leading thread. So, but as it's difficult to represent on this, not small screen, but I've chosen to simplify it like that. So this is one of the sources, the thematic leading thread, created by Hans von Wolzogen, and it has as its subject another work, The Ring des Nibelungen by Richard Wagner. And then we can also assert that this is the person, and this is the person who know each other. And this thematic leading thread has several expressions, as it's called in Ferber. So in the Ferber model, you have a work, which is the conceptual intellectual idea, and which can have several different expressions, which are the concrete forms it can take. So it has, for example, an expression which is the first edition, and it has an expression which is a translation. And each of these expressions are also related, or can also be related, to specific expressions of the work that the thematic leading thread refers to. So, for instance, the first edition of Wolzogen's thematic leading thread was written on occasion of the premiere of The Ring, and this translation was published on occasion of the first performance in England. So it helps us to, using this model, helps us to identify implicit relationships and assert them explicitly so that we can later deal with them and can use them in our analysis. And then we have the structural analysis of the sources, of the source content, of the interpretations themselves. And we also have already seen that a little bit. So this extraction of the elements in the specific interpretations, in the specific interpretations of leitmotifs, this is already a kind of structural analysis. So the thing with these leitmotif guides is that they are, in a way, highly structured sources. They follow the chronology of the work, and they very systematically, mostly, extract leitmotifs and describe them with a fixed pool of representational elements. So what I've been doing is I've made this, which is just a collection, an extraction of the content from the source, into an explicit model. So we have a leitmotif concept, which can be defined by several different presentational elements. And in the beginning I talked about that it's kind of difficult to compare leitmotifs to each other, and I've chosen not to model every relationship between every source in detail, but rather to relate every instance to three more or less objective meta categories, which are on the one hand the semantic sphere, which would be something as fate or love or something like that, which will be able to connect all the motifs connected with a specific dramatic idea, for instance. Then a second level, which identifies the musical idea behind it, which also makes it possible to have different categories of motifs which are exactly the same, which have the same musical idea, but refer to a different place in the work, and things like that. And then we have, as a third category, the place within the work, which is also kind of a unique identification. So if we assign these dimensions to the concept, it makes it possible to compare them, because each of them will have certain elements which it has in common with others. And then we can go and abstract this a little further. So we've seen leitmotif concepts from Wolzogen's leitmotif guide and leitmotif concepts from Heinrich Porges's rehearsal notes. And each of them were a little different. Each used different presentational elements. So we can have a general concept of leitmotif concepts, and then specifications, subclasses, which specify a certain author's leitmotif concept, which only can have certain certain presentational elements. For example, in Wolzogen's guide, we will never have a sound example, just to pick a very simple example. And this is how we connect this to the contextual information, if you remember this other diagram, where we had the thematic leading thread and its connections to the work and to its expressions. And this is the place where we can connect it, because we say this work contains certain leitmotif concepts. But I wanted to go even a little further, because leitmotif interpretation, in a way, can be seen as a special case of music analysis or music interpretation in general, because in many ways it contains the same components that we encounter in most music analyses or most music interpretations. Because many of these things, notation examples or analytical constructs, because a leitmotif concept is nothing else than an analytical construct. It chooses certain elements from the score, it chooses certain elements from the music, and represents them to make a certain point about the music. And so I've come to this more general model that represents music analysis or interpretation in general. So we have a reception document of some form, which can be a music interpretation or a music analysis, which contains analytical constructs. This would, for example, be a leitmotif concept, which also contains analytical statements. And each of them, so which can be observations or conclusions. And each of them can be defined by the presentational elements that we already saw, that can also be grouped into several classes. We have relations to other constructs, we have description of the construct, which can be associative or structural, so involving some sort of expression or meaning or whatever the context, or being referring to the musical structure. And we have things that identify the musical phenomenon that is talked about. We have sound examples, notations, as we have already seen. So this is, in a way, a way to generalize this model that was specifically developed for the leitmotif concepts. But this essentially could be used to structure all kinds of music analysis or interpretation. Because you can could also imagine, for instance, an analysis of a sonata or a symphony, which is also often, depending on the theory that you look at, but it's also often highly structured. You have, for example, theme constructs, the first subject, the second subject. These are also analytical constructs, which also have presentational elements. They have designations like first subject, second subject, medial, caesura, or whatever. Just to conclude, so this is an attempt to make the structure, the categorization that I would have any way to do in organizing music interpretations and comparing them to each other, to drawing this together in an explicit model, and furthermore generalizing it to music interpretation in general. And as more musicological scholarship gets published digitally, that might be an opportunity to structure the analyses that we publish, because I think it would be quite neat if we could if we had a search engine that could not only look for document titles, but for instance answer queries such as, give me all musical analyses of Brahms' Second Symphony that deal with the interpretation, the instrumentation of the first subject, or something like this. So this is the most general idea behind this. Yeah, and so essentially, I hope that this model will help me to structure the sources, will help me to make information explicit, and to enable me to restructure and search this corpus of material. Thank you very much.